Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowan Aker, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. And this morning on the Morning Show, we will hear about a clinic in Uganda co-founded by Albany women and supported by Albany women currently. We'll also hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
Hey, this is David Poe, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Meredith Coy of Atlanta, Georgia. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Thursday, July 20th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. Nick Reisman reports for Spectrum News that on July 17th, State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli's office reported the state took in almost $7 billion less in the first quarter of the fiscal year in 2023 than New York received in the same quarter last year. State revenue from personal income taxes fell $7.1 billion in the first fiscal quarter of 2023. Mid-Hudson News reports that DiNapoli has now issued a report warning that the state's deficit could climb to $36 billion in 2027 if lawmakers don't change their spending policies. DiNapoli's deficit report says, quote, "Our position is that you shouldn't be spending all of those reserves to balance the gaps. The deteriorating fiscal outlook is rooted in several factors, including anticipated revenue declines from a weakening economy and a volatile stock market and increases in recurring spending," unquote. DiNapoli also warned that recent weather events will likely cost the state more in rebuilding costs. Read more about this story at Spectrum News. WTEN reports that Ulster County Legislature unanimously adopted the Drag is Not a Crime Act on July 18th to protect drag performers. The act adds gender expression to the Ulster County Human Rights Law. Ulster County Legislature Vice Chair Peter Criswell said, quote, "By passing this proposed local law, we are announcing to the country that Ulster County is a welcoming place for everyone to live and express themselves as they truly are without fear of discrimination. I am grateful to those who gave public comments and emails, letters, and postcards and called their legislator in favor of this law," unquote. Recently, the Woodstock Library held a drag story hour, which went on after the board mulled complaints that did not want the show to go on. Read more about this at the WTEN website. Roger Hannigan-Gilson reports in the Times-Union that after a group filed a Federal Elections Commission complaint alleging that Representative Mark Molinaro illegally transferred $2,000 from his former campaign for Dutchess County Executive into his current re-election campaign. Molinaro on June 8th returned the money to his dormant Dutchess County campaign account. In April, the group End Citizens United filed the complaint, alleging the money transfer violated federal campaign finance law. End Citizens United spokesperson Pawadin Syed asserts that the return of the $2,000 to the Dutchess County Campaign Committee amounted to Molinaro, quote, "shamefully admitting wrongdoing in his own quarterly report," unquote. The Molinaro campaign did not explain the money transfers, with Molinaro campaign advisor Dave Catalfamo saying, quote, "The Molinaro campaign has always and will continue to comply with all state and federal laws," unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Paul Kirby reports for the Daily Freeman that Representative Mark Molinaro said July 18th that he will vote to censure fellow Republican George Santos. Molinaro previously voted against kicking Santos out of Congress. Democrats are expected to introduce a censure resolution into the House soon. Molinaro said, quote, "George Santos should not be a member of Congress. I called for his resignation months ago, and I'd censure him now," unquote. Republicans have just a 4-seat majority in the House of Representatives and don't seem likely to remove one of their members, even with a record of lying like Santos. The Long Island congressperson has been charged with embezzling money from his campaign, falsely receiving unemployment funds, and lying to Congress about his finances. Molinaro represents the 19th congressional district. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman, and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, July 20th. Local early morning temperatures range from 54 degrees in Steventown to 61 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 72 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be medium, smoke levels will be low, and air quality will be generally good. It is shaping up to be a sunny summer day that will be mostly comfortable at least until 11 a.m. and we get a high temperature of 85 degrees at 4 p.m. Cloud cover will be low, so those cars will be extra hot. No leaving pets, the baby, or grandma in there, okay? And make sure to protect from UV. It will be strong. We are comfy again by 10 p.m., and we will see a low of 68 overnight. Rain chances return by the morning commute and will intensify through the day tomorrow. We will see a high of only 78 degrees, and that happens at 4 p.m. Overnight dips to 62 degrees, then we get maybe moist Saturday with a high of 79. Then we will have a dry Sunday with a high of 84, and a low enough looking dew point to make getting outside really worth it. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 5:18 a.m., low tide at 12:12 p.m., high tide again at 6:06 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 74 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 8:13 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:33 a.m. Looking way up, we see a double whammy Hadouken could ring our magnetic field today. That could attenuate signals once it happens, and that means cell phones could drop calls in rural areas, GPSs could glitch, and radio equipment gets wonky. We have a 15% chance of X-class flares. Plasma winds will be slow at 378 kilometers per second with a thin density of 3 protons per cubic centimeter. That's just for now. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair across the board with good conditions below 28 megahertz overnight. Again, those predictions are just for now. There are low chances of aurora tonight. The current sunspot number is 141, and this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate, who want to remind you just how important you are. If you can hear me, you're part of our community, and it's members just like you that help us keep the network up and running, and you do so in so many ways. If the financial route is what works for you, donating is easy. Just head on over to wgxe.org and hit that donate button.
This is really me now. No more hiding. Listen, we're all worried. We're all in pain. That comes with having eyes, with having ears. But just remember one thing. It can't get any worse. It can only get better. Quitting is not going to make you strong. Living will. So just hang on and hang in there. You know, I know all about the hating and the sneering. I'm a member of the Why Bother generation myself. But why did I bother to come out here tonight? And why did you? I mean, it's time. It begins with us, not with politicians, the experts, or the teachers, but with us. With you and with me, the ones who need it most. I believe with everything that's in me, that the whole world is longing for healing. Even the trees, the earth itself are crying out for it. You can hear it everywhere. It's the same kind of healing I desperately needed, and finally feel has begun with you.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
People should have confidence in our election system and a belief that their vote counts. Our democracy must be perpetually defended by every generation of Americans.
Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel says felony charges have been filed against 16 Republicans who acted as fake electors for then-President Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. They're accused of submitting false certificates contending they were legitimate electors despite Joe Biden's victory in the state. The top charges carry a maximum penalty of 14 years in prison. Several Democrats boycotted Israeli President Isaac Herzog's speech before a joint session of Congress Wednesday. Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan says attending would normalize violence against those living in the occupied West Bank.
The United Nations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Israel's own largest human rights organization, B'Tselem, all agree that Israel is an apartheid state.
Meanwhile, the House passed a resolution reaffirming its support for Israel with bipartisan backing. Republican Representative Elise Stefanik of New York says strong ties with Israel are needed now more than ever.
Especially as our adversaries are increasingly emboldened around the world due to Joe Biden's weakness on the global stage.
President Biden has called the current Israeli government the most extreme he has seen in decades as it seeks to overhaul its judicial system. The Senate Judiciary Committee is set to vote on a bill which would create a binding code of ethics for the U.S. Supreme Court. Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island says the bill would impose new requirements for financial disclosures and for recusal from cases in which a justice may have a conflict of interest.
There is dark money influence around the court that is very unhealthy for the institution.
Recent reporting revealed some conservative justices have failed to disclose luxury trips with Republican donors as well as real estate transactions. The state of Maine has enacted one of the least restrictive abortion laws in the country. Governor Janet Mills says the law allows women to receive an abortion at any time if deemed medically necessary by a doctor.
We got to take government out of the decision-making process and put the doctor and patient in charge.
Mills says abortions later in pregnancy are extremely rare. Republican Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire says he will not seek a fifth term in office. Sununu had previously considered a presidential bid in 2024, but warned a crowded field could lead to a Trump renomination. And Phoenix, Arizona has set a heat record with temperatures reaching 110 degrees for 19 consecutive days. 86 million Americans live in areas currently experiencing dangerous heat levels. Scientists say human-caused climate change and a newly formed El Niño in the Pacific are combining to break heat records worldwide. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Tuesday, leaders of the U.S. House and Senate reintroduced the Freedom to Vote Act, the sweeping democracy reform bill narrowly defeated in the U.S. Senate in 2022. The GOP's recently introduced American Confidence in Elections Act attempts to nationalize extreme state restrictions on voting. In contrast, the Freedom to Vote Act dramatically expands and protects access to the polls. It mandates 2 weeks of early voting nationwide for federal elections, creates national standards for access to mail-in absentee voting, and outlaws recently enacted state voter suppression tactics. Voter ID options would be expanded, and voting accessibility for the disabled required. Opportunities for voter registration would include automatic voter registration at the DMV, online registration, and same-day registration. New rules would prevent partisan-driven purges of voter lists without adequate notification. The Freedom to Vote Act also bans partisan gerrymandering, and with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, restores sections of the Voting Rights Act struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Dark money organizations and PACs would be required to disclose their donors, and a voluntary small donor matching campaign finance system for Congress would be established to reduce the hold of special interests. While the bill came close to passage in 2022, its prospects are dimmer this time with a divided House and Senate. We have complete details on the bill at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Little different style, different fashion, you know? No? Tell me, say one thing, Nancy, can't understand. One thing, Nancy, can't understand. What make them talk about me ambition? Say what make them talk about me ambition? Come and say some of them ask me where me get it from. Tell some of them ask me where me get it from. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. I told them, no, no, it's from creation. Bam, bam. What a bam 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 dilang bam 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 dilang bam 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 hey what a bam bam ta what a bam bam this woman never trouble no one I'm a lady I'm not a man MC is my ambition I come free nice of Jamaican so bam. What a bam bam, hey, tell me say what a bam bam,
That was Sister Nancy with Bam Bam on the radio at WGXC.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and now on the phone we have with us Shelley Hagen, the president and CEO of the Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood. Welcome to the WGXC Afternoon Show, Shelley.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We have you, I guess, mostly because it's anniversary day, or somewhere in this month, about a year ago, the Supreme Court changed the laws in the country on abortion, and we're wondering what that means for Americans and specifically New Yorkers in the Upper Hudson Valley.
Well, I think that for Americans, it means that half of the country is already experiencing extreme restrictions on their access to basic freedoms. I think while we have not seen an enormous growth in the number of people coming to upstate New York seeking abortion care, we are all impacted when so many people are denied just the basic freedom of autonomy to make decisions for themselves with their doctors. Here in New York, we are in an incredibly privileged position in that we have a governor who has really put her energy and her reputation behind supporting access to abortion in New York State. We have a very active assembly and Senate in New York State that have worked to pass laws protecting not only abortion, but abortion providers. And as effective this year, we actually saw an increase in the amount that New York State Medicaid will be reimbursing providers in order to provide abortion. So, you know, the picture here in New York State is really quite different than it is in parts of the country where we have seen complete and total bans. We have seen the criminalization of doctors. We have seen the criminalization of people supporting their loved ones in the pursuit of an abortion when they feel that they need one. And so it's just a really, we are just becoming more and more a divided country. And I think this Supreme Court has a lot to answer for.
And so you talked about Governor Kathy Hochul and the legislature. They've done a bunch in a year. Are there things that you're happy they did, or things that that you wish they had done already?
You know, as an advocate, we're always like pushing the state to do more and more. That's kind of our responsibility. There are ways that we hope that we can continue to protect access to abortion, particularly by passing the Equal Rights Amendment. And so what we have here in New York State in order to experience the sort of direct democracy of a ballot initiative is that we have to go through a process where the initiative passes the state legislature in two separate sessions. So we were able to pass the Equal Rights Amendment in the last two sessions, which means that it will be on the ballot in 2024. And I was incredibly disappointed in the way that the coverage of this sort of initiative was initially announced. This is not just a political football. It's not a political game. We have a constitution in New York State that protects people for differences related to race and religion only. And so that leaves a lot of people out of the New York State Constitution in terms of their protection. And this goes further than any other state. It includes people that they cannot be discriminated against based on gender identity, sexual orientation, gender expression, ability, national origin, pregnancy outcomes, and of course, gender. That's incredibly broad ranging, and that's how it should be. You know, we are all multiple things, and the intersectionality of issues as they relate not only to abortion, but fair housing and employment and so many other things that affect our day-to-day life really intersects all of our various identities. And so the Equal Rights Amendment is incredibly important, and we look forward to passing that in 2024.
Are you confident about that or worried about it? Because it's a presidential year, so the turnout will be high.
The turnout will be high, and that, I believe, is a good thing. Certainly early polling shows that New Yorkers strongly believe that basic freedom should be protected, that all of our rights should be protected equally. I feel incredibly confident that New Yorkers want an equal rights amendment. I think my only concern is that we're not used to ballot initiatives in New York, and we're not always that good at knowing how to vote on them. So it's going to be a lot of voter education throughout the year next year around how to vote on the ballot initiative and what it means to do so.
And I guess the good news on that front is that not in New York, but in other states in the past year, abortion has been on the ballot a few times, and I don't believe it has lost anywhere, has it?
No, it has not. If abortion is on the ballot, it wins because, contrary to the incredibly powerful public communications staffs in the anti-choice movement, access to abortion really is not political for most people. It is not something that most Americans think should be up for debate. And so a basic healthcare service has been politicized for the last 50 years. And once Roe was overturned, people realized that they meant business. When they said they wanted to overturn Roe, they meant it. And when they wanted to ban abortion, they meant it. I think what people should be deeply concerned about is the same groups that have worked so hard and so long to limit access to abortion are just as interested in limiting access to contraception and limiting access to many of the basic rights that we have grown accustomed to in a society that has valued some level of gender parity. And that is something that is slipping through our fingers right now.
Is there a chance the Supreme Court will outlaw that or do something else in this arena?
Well, I think that in the Dobbs ruling, Justice Thomas outlined the fact that many other issues that the court had ruled on in the past should be revisited. And one of those was Griswold versus Connecticut. So that was access to abortion for married people. And I think it's really important for people to realize that was only in the 1970s. It was around that same time that a woman cannot even get a credit card in her own name. We're talking about turning back the clock on a expectation that we have of being able to live relatively free and independent lives as women or people who identify as women. And that is definitely something I have a lot of concern for.
I wanted to just see. It seems like it's probably been a tough year for you. It seems like every day you wake up to another story. On July 19th, here the story is in Texas with the this trial that's going on and this testimony. There was this woman giving testimony today, telling about how she was forced to give birth to the baby had some problems or whatever, but she actually vomited on the stand today. And it seems like every day there's a story like that. A teen in Indiana being taken across state line, you could just go through it. Just, there's so many stories.
Well, and those are the stories we hear about. You know, the reality is those stories are happening and have happened for a really long time as access to abortion care in many of the states that now have full and total bans had very little access to care in the past. And for people who could afford care, there was at least a way to get it. But there have been and continue to be story after story after story that's not going to make the news, of a person who finds themselves pregnant and doesn't want to be. Maybe they're in a domestic violence situation. Maybe they're young. Maybe. There's a million reasons, and none of those reasons are better or worse than others. And they're just deciding that they're going to end up carrying a pregnancy to term, regardless of what their intention was, because they are resigned to the fact that they don't have access, and in this country are treated as if they don't deserve access to a basic piece of human of healthcare. And those stories are happening under the radar. The ones that are happening above the radar, yeah, they are shocking, and they are going to keep happening. And sadly, I believe they're going to get much worse.
Yeah, it seems like we don't have a real way to keep track of mass shootings in this country. Is there? Do you have any idea how many women have died in the past year because of the Dobbs ruling?
I don't have that information. I do think that that's information that like public health departments are going to be looking at over the coming years for sure.
But it's kind of hard to even get that data together, right? Because people die. It's, you know, can you say one thing was the total cause or, you know, 80% of the cause? You know, there's lots and they don't all work together. And there's states that probably don't want to share the information.
Well, we already see states that don't want to share the information, especially when it comes to issues of maternal mortality and the increasing understanding that maternal mortality is disproportionately happening among people of color. And so we have states that don't want to share that data, and they really don't have to.
Any other, well, back to New York and people here, what do you recommend if they want to do something about this issue? What is the best thing that, the most effective thing that people could do?
I mean, that's always a great question. I think it's difficult. It's a more difficult to answer question here in New York than it is in other places. Certainly reach out to places like Upper Hudson Planned Parenthood, and you can reach us at uhpp.org. We are always looking for volunteers and support and people who want to do that work. I think it's also very effective to call your legislators. Make sure that they know how you stand on the issue. Regardless of how your particular representative may have voted in the past, it's really important for them to hear people's voices. Because one of the things that folks on the more restrictive side of the debate have been very effective at doing is making it seem as if their position is normal and normalizing a restrictive climate that really is not what most Americans believe in. And if you don't, you really should let somebody know. Writing letters to the editor, letting your community know where you stand on the issue, being willing to have difficult conversations about abortion and why access to abortion is important to you, regardless of if you're Black or white or a woman or man or gender nonconforming. It's important to all of us, and I think it's important to have those conversations in our communities.
And I wanted to remind listeners that you guys opened a new spot in Hudson a couple years ago. I don't know, my COVID brain doesn't remember exactly. How long has it been?
We actually opened in 2019, not too long before
COVID. So it was before COVID, yeah.
It was. And what's most exciting about Hudson and our healthcare services in Hudson is 5 years ago, we were only open 1 or 2 days a week. And as of last month, the health center in Hudson's open 5 days a week. So they're there to serve people all week long, which is really important. And that has been like a really steadfast investment of not only our staff's unbelievable skill and time, but also a lot of community investment in terms of donations and foundation support to make sure that we could keep that health center open multiple days a week.
And
rural healthcare is difficult. You know, the volume, it makes it harder to do and makes it harder to staff for and all of those things.
Well, you've led me directly into my next question perfectly. What is the hospital in Troy called? I'm forgetting.
Samaritan Hospital, yeah. Which is part of the St. Peter's Health Systems.
So in 2011, they merged and eliminated some birthing services at one of the two, because there were, instead of two hospitals doing birthing, there's only one because they merged. And then 2019, fix me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, actually what happened was when they merged, they eliminated a lot of women's healthcare because it was taken over by a Catholic hospital that does not allow access to abortion or contraception, tubal ligation during cesarean sections, which is the medical standard of care. They don't allow assisted abortion in the management of miscarriage. They don't allow for many treatments that are considered the standard of care for ectopic pregnancies. So when those two hospitals merged, the community really came together and they agreed to open what was called the Burdett Women's Health Center that allowed for it to be carved out from the Catholic directives to a certain degree. So now what's happening is they're eliminating the birthing center. Now, the birthing center at Burdett has exceptionally great health outcomes, and they have a very, very low cesarean section rate, far lower than the state average. The community has been so committed to that birthing center for quite some time, and they announced, really quite surprisingly, that they were going to discontinue doing delivery services in Troy, New York. And I remember this going on when Columbia Memorial decided to discontinue delivery services. However, the two are really kind of different. When Columbia Memorial discontinued services, they were providing way fewer than 600 deliveries a year. And there's a lot in the data that says if a service is not provided more than 600 times a year, that the risks go up, the health outcomes go down. There were real health risks. And while it's difficult to have a lack of service in any community, I could at least wrap my head around that. I could wrap my head around the patient safety aspect.
But although it makes it more dangerous for home births who use the hospital as a backup plan, right?
It makes it more dangerous for the hospital to deliver there. It makes it more dangerous. It's never really great to have a home birth that ends up in an emergency room. That's not where the most qualified staff is either.
But that's what's happening at Columbia Memorial now, right?
That's what's happening at Columbia Memorial now. However, Columbia Memorial, had they maintained their birthing facility, they were at risk for the same level of problems and poor health outcomes because of the low number of deliveries in Columbia County, period.
So it was similar. The care was similar to now when it's in the emergency room, right? They have to deal with an emergency room now, and it's not great. And you're saying because they didn't reach 600, it wasn't great then either.
Exactly. It's a terrible situation, and there's a lot that needs to be addressed when it comes to rural health delivery risks. What's happening in Troy, though, is different. What's happening in Troy is St. Peter's Health Systems doesn't see Burdett Care as profitable enough. They do over 1,000 deliveries every year. Those deliveries have incredibly good outcomes, but they're not going to surgery, and that's where the money is. So they have a primarily midwife-driven practice. And these midwives have incredibly great outcomes. They also work with doulas there who are incredibly helpful in making sure that we have real positive birth outcomes in Troy. And what that means is the hospital's not making enough money. And the main reason that they cited for doing this in the newspaper was that it was not profitable enough.
It was like $2.5 million they said they were losing or something like that.
Yeah.
You think that's ridiculous, that number?
I think that's ridiculous, especially when you consider the huge increases to Medicaid reimbursement for hospitals that was included in this year's state budget and the sheer amount of money that was pushed into hospitals through the federal government during COVID. So I think it's just a question of someone being part of Trinity Health, which is located in Michigan, that owns tons of hospitals throughout the country. We're looking at, like, it's big business. It's big business in the name of healthcare. And so what they're doing is they're looking at probably a spreadsheet that says, here's a hospital that it has a very tight margin, and there's another hospital only 10, 12 miles away that we could just merge them into. But what they're not looking at is health outcomes. They're not looking at what the community needs, and they're not looking at the way the community functions. We don't have a lot of people in Troy who are using the hospital who also have means for transportation. In an urban setting like Troy, you have to take a bus, and to get on a bus from downtown Troy to get to the hospital over here in Albany would be over an hour on the bus. On the bus, for anybody who's ever had a baby or been with someone having a baby, that's a shocking thing to say. So
and if you're coming from Nassau, it's 2 hours. Southern Rensselaer, Southern Rensselaer
County. If you're coming from NASA, I don't know if you can get a bus. Right. Then you have a car. to drive it is close. It's a 10-15 minute drive. I personally live in Troy and work in Albany. It takes me 14 minutes to get to my office in my car. But that's very different for people who live in the city and don't necessarily drive. I mean, it's shocking. It's disappointing. It's also completely underhanded in how it was done. The state passed a requirement that hospitals making significant changes to their services have to undergo an equity test, and an external auditor has to come in and identify what will the health equity impact of this change be. They slipped their application in the day before that rule went into place. And that's not a surprise. And that's not, and then they're also not alone. Across the state, many hospitals did things to make sure that they wouldn't fall into the requirement that their actual behavior gets looked at through the lens of health equity and what it means to their community. So yeah, we're in for a fight up in Troy right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, do you think it has a chance? I mean, in Hudson, there you know, the mayor was upset, and he still says some things about it once in a while, but there wasn't a coalition of officials. In Rensselaer, there's been Rensselaer County, there's been a letter that signed on by Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin, who is basically Trump heavier, I don't know, and the Democratic mayor of Troy, and all these other people that are not political bedfellows, let's say.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very bipartisan issue. And like I say, not to diminish how terrible it is that there is not a birthing center in Columbia County, because there needs to be one. And there should be there, and there hasn't been one in Greene County in a very long time. So, you know, rural communities are really struggling under the impact of the way that the healthcare system is consolidating itself. I think the difference in it being in the city of Troy is because it is so clearly profit motivated, that there is nothing that anyone can say that points to there being an issue around patient safety or patient outcomes. The only thing they can say about the Burdett Birthing Center was that patient safety was topmost of mind, that the staff that worked there had incredibly good outcomes. And so the only reason that they're doing this is for profit.
And so do you think the coalition of politicians from both sides of the aisle are going to get this done? Or what, again, the question, what's the effective thing for people to do if they want to have an effect on this policy?
If you're really interested in getting engaged, you can reach out to our office. Again, if you go through the website, uhpp.org, go to info@ and send an email and say it's something you want to engage in. We do have some community organizers who are working here out of our office and can connect you to the larger coalition of people who are doing this. They're planning rallies and speak outs and listening sessions and all sorts of things to make sure that people feel as informed as they can. We don't have a direct democracy tool on this. This isn't a democratic decision. However, we can really plead our case to the Department of Health, because ultimately approval or disapproval of this change will come to the Department of Health. That's where it sits right now. They have tentatively agreed to do the health equity audit. I think that is...
The hospital has?
The hospital has. I think that has come in direct effect of the advocacy coalition that's been very loud and vocal. The governor has been supportive of the work that the legislators are doing. Certainly we have our local politicians, as well as John McDonald, our assemblyman, and he's been incredibly helpful and thoughtful in how we can try to affect some change. So if you want to get involved, I would say reach out through the UHPP. It's info@uhpp.org. If you just want to send an email and say that you're interested, we can get you some information.
And the attorney general has weighed in on this. Is that a political grandstanding, or does she have could she have an effect on this?
You know, she's incredibly smart and has a lot of levers at her disposal. So I don't know what exactly the attorney general could do. And oh, that we live in a state that it's a politically savvy move to stand up for something like this. That is like, yeah, another area where when I spend time with colleagues from across the country, they're like our attorney general would ever stand up for us. It could be, I honestly don't know what legal levers there are to pull. I am hopeful that this will result just simply in the Department of Health rejecting the request. But if that doesn't happen, I don't know what comes next.
All right. We've been speaking with Shelley Hogan from the Upper Planned Parenthood based in Troy, but also with an office in Hudson. Anything else that you want to tell listeners?
If you are interested in supporting us, we are holding a event at Farmet in Germantown on Thursday, the 27th. Again, that same email address, if you're looking for information, info@uhpp.org. I will just double check. Yeah, it is at 5:30 p.m. at Farmet in Germantown.
And what sort of event? Is it just a fundraiser or is there?
It's a fundraiser. It's a garden party. And the amazing proprietresses of Farmet are hosting us for the evening. So it should be lovely.
All right. So that's not this coming Thursday, but next Thursday.
Next Thursday.
So thank you for joining us today and doing your work. And hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
This is Bria Barthel for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Frequent listeners know that this is a hyper-local program to the Capital Region, and yet here I am about to talk with two people about something in Uganda, and yet there's an Albany connection. So Matt Licori, Vice President of Communications for Ngeye, is going to start us off by telling us what is it and how does it connect to Albany.
Thank you so much for having us. Ngeye is an organization that was co-founded by an Albany medical student named Stephanie Van Dyke and a Ugandan named John Kulule almost 20 years ago at this point. They identified a significant need in the community in terms of health and empowerment, general uplifting of the area that John grew up in, an area that he loved. And they started out by building this clinic to serve the people of Degea. And in the past 20 years, the organization has grown. It had started off as a visiting health clinic, only open when Albany doctors or other healthcare professionals were visiting Uganda. Now it's a full-time clinic staffed 6 days a week, maternity center staff 24/7 that employs 13 Ugandan nationals full-time. As the organization has grown, it's branched out into a scholars program as well. So while the organization was initially founded on this health clinic, it now supports upwards of 20 students who show great promise in the region but do not have the means or the financial backing to pursue an education.
Thanks for mentioning the Scholars Program. I'm now going to switch over to Amy Haven, who is the Vice President for the Scholars portion of this, and maybe you can tell us something about who the Scholars are and how you help them out and what's going on.
Ngeye is located in a small rural village called Degea, and we as an Ngeye board and as an organization as a whole have identified around 20 students. As Matt mentioned, show academic promise, but lack the financial ability to attend school. In Uganda, most schools are boarding, so there's an added cost of room and board, uniforms, in addition to the typical school books and transportation. The 20 students that we've worked with have been covered through primary school and have the option to be financially sponsored through university should they choose to attend. Last year, we had two students from our scholars program graduate from university. One of them just received a teaching job in the city, and the other one is currently seeking employment in the tourism industry.
So the scholars that you sponsor, it's not necessarily to work at the health clinic?
No. We encourage students to pursue any career path that interests them. There is no commitment for these students to work at Ngeye as the health clinic. We just ask that they give back to their local community that has lifted them up for this opportunity.
Now, I was surprised to hear that someone had traveled to come to the board of directors meeting recently. The directors are from other areas, too?
That's correct. So Ngaye has an Ngaye Inc. board of directors, which is the 501 U.S. nonprofit organization, and that works in tandem with a Ugandan board of directors who oversees the day-to-day operations of the clinic. So there's an executive director, John Kalule, who was the co-founder, who leads that board, and they work in tandem with the United States board. While it was initially founded by Stephanie Van Dyke in Albany Med and that, you know, network, it's grown nationally in a sense where Amy herself is up from Atlanta today. Sarah Yergo, another board member, is here from Washington, D.C. There's a presence in Portland, Oregon. And as physicians and others who have become involved in the organization have spread out over the past 15, 20 years and introduced others to the organization, we are pretty well spread out throughout the United States at this point. Mainly focused in Albany, but spread throughout.
Now, when you say focused in Albany, can you give me a sense of like how many people at Albany Med are involved or if people from other places are involved?
Yeah, Albany Med, I just say in that that's where kind of sprung from, but it's a community of, I would say we're expecting upwards of 75 people to be here celebrating Bridget's graduation, who was a former clinic in charge at Ngaye, who recently graduated with her MPH from UAlbany. They're teachers, they're just a network of people that have grown to understand and love this community and interact and find ways to help in different ways beyond just Albany Med physicians or medically trained professionals.
And I was talking with someone who said she's gone to Uganda 12 times now. Have either of you traveled there?
Actually, both Matt and I lived in Uganda for 9 months. Matt was there from 2018 to 2019, and I lived there from 2019 up until the COVID outbreak. We both attended Union College in Schenectady, which had a very close partnership for 12 years with Ngaye, in which graduating seniors from Union went to live in Degea and work at Ngaye for around 9 months. And I'd say from the majority of us have continued our commitment to Ngaye since moving back to the United States. I had the opportunity to go back to Ngaye this past April, and I was able to bring my mom along, and that was a really great way to introduce her to the organization more formally. Matt has gone back twice now. He was also able to bring his mom, so really trying to engage the families and expand our network.
Tell us a little something about what you've seen in Uganda and how it has changed through time if you've been back a few times.
Absolutely. So I first became involved in 2018. The organization had matured significantly to that point. As I talked about, it started as a visiting clinic. When I was there, the maternity center had just been built. So I was in Degea for the first birth at the new maternity center, which was incredible. The hospitals that have birthing centers are cost prohibitive in a lot of ways. So having a maternity center in the villages where people are able to deliver locally in a safe, high-quality environment has really transitioned the maternal care there.
And certainly listeners in Troy who are facing the possible closing of the Burdett Birthing Center can understand the importance of having local services.
Absolutely. Going back in April, as Amy talked about, we were able to see how that's grown over the past 5 or 6 years. Clinic sees annually anywhere between 15 and 20,000 patients. The maternity center alone did over 2,000 immunizations last year and close to 100 deliveries. One of the aspects of the maternity center I think we're most proud of is the continued continuity of care, the antenatal care, the postnatal care. We're able to work with the local mothers from the time, whether they're doing family planning all the way up through having children and then all of the follow-up that's associated with it. So really a family medicine mentality, and we're trying to continue to evolve the maternity care in the region.
So perhaps you can tell us the town that it's located in, how large the town is, and what other medical facilities might be nearby.
Absolutely. So the town is called Degea, part of a larger sub-parish called Nakatete, made up of a number of villages in similar size but relatively close proximity. There is one government facility nearby, but it's a level 2 facility, which means that it only needs to be staffed by one nurse. So think of an area that we see 17,000 patients in a year, there's one nurse that would staff that clinic. And there are other options further into town, but you know, that becomes more costly for travel and other things and difficult to access. So the majority of the patients in the region will be seen at Ngaye. And this is kind of the void that the clinic attempts to fill because of the low level of clinic that is available through the public sector.
If people were interested in helping out, what kind of support do you need from the community?
We look for people with specific expertise. We work very hard to ensure there's no volunteerism or anything like that, and that the needs of the community go first. So typically teams that we bring over are medical in nature, unless there's some other connection. An example would be the maternity center has an ultrasound machine, one of few in the area, and there's limited training on ultrasounds for general practitioners that we have at the clinic. So if someone had advanced training in ultrasound, that would be very attractive to us as an organization, and be in on a trip to where you could, you know, apply those skills and help train those who work at the clinic day to day on advanced techniques and using it. But beyond that, there's a lot that goes into running an organization that sees 18,000 patients, manages 20 scholars, and works on other initiatives for women and others in the area. The only thing you really need is to have an appreciation for helping others, and there's so many things you can do from abroad that assist in the clinic. The committee that I lead maintains our website. We're always looking for creative-minded people, marketing, web design, really any skills or interests that you might have. There's probably some branch of the organization that you're able to help in. So I want to emphasize that visiting and going to the clinic in Degea is not the extent of it. And it's all managed and run by volunteers on the U.S. side.
And if people want more information, how would they get in touch with you?
We have a website. If you go to www.ngaye.org, you will have an opportunity to see a bit of our history and learn a bit more about the region as a whole and our motto of health, education, and empowerment.
Okay, and again, that's Ngaye, E-N-G-E-Y-E. It is a nonprofit, 501c3. Thank you, Matt Licori, Vice President of Communications, and Amy Haven, Vice President for Scholars, for everything you're doing and for taking time to talk with our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The Bismarck is going off. The Bismarck.